come to order. If they're in the room, members, we have our two pages now permanently assigned to us. Are they around and can introduce themselves? Maybe they're working too hard. Please introduce yourself and tell us where you're coming from and where you're going after. Second page.
Oh, I'm Kyle.
And Representative Fisher, I think you had a chance to look at the minutes.
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. I move the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, February 19th, 2020.
Fisher moves approval. Are there any other corrections that anyone else saw? Not. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Those minutes are approved. Representative Hassan is running 10 minutes late, and so we're changing the order a bit. We're going to start with 3348, Representative Kerr. We have a quorum now, so I think there are a couple of author's amendments. Members, all of these bills, with the exception of mine, they all are referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. So as you think about your questions, if you can sort out, we know there's going to be a vigorous debate on those, the judiciary issues that might be relevant to the committee. So we'll try to focus on the housing pieces as we get clarity about it. Representative Herr, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yes, I would like to move that House File 3348 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. I do have an author's amendment, an A1 amendment.
A1 amendment. To get the bill before us in the way the author intends, are you moving that A1 amendment?
Sorry, Madam Chair, to get all my notes in order. Yes, and this does just put my bill into the form that I want. So there's no technical changes to it.
So Representative Herr moves the A1 amendment. Do you want to? That's just technical, you said?
Yes, that's the only one, Madam.
Deleting a section. Any question about the A1 amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That bill is now before us as amended.
Right, Madam Chair, I'm just getting my notes in order here really quick here because we do have three bills in front of you today. So Madam Chair and committee, the bill in front of you is House File 3348. It is a bill that proposes to deal with two issues related to fairness for tenants and leases. The first concerns some landlords charging non-optional fees for expenses that should simply be included in the cost of rent. And the second issue is tenants deserve the right to privacy in their home, which is part of what they pay their rent for and deserve. And so, Madam Chair, I could go over the details of the bill, but I think that it might be better served if I have my testifier go through some of the walk everyone through sort of the details of it, and then we can have a discussion after.
And that is Mr. McDonough.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Lawrence McDonough. I'm a pro bono counsel at Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here with Homeline and the Homes for All Coalition. They've been working together for a couple of years. It's a diverse base of around 240 organizations. They're really working towards smart, targeted, impactful policies that will have immediate and long-lasting impact on thousands of tenants across the state. So the bill that you have before you has two components. One is dealing with certain mandatory fees that are, in our view, kind of hidden in the landlord-tenant process. Tenants, probably a lot of you have been tenants at some point in your life, and maybe even now when you're here at the Capitol. So you talk to a landlord, and you talk about a lease, talk about the rent, and then you look at the lease, and there are a number of mandatory charges you can't refuse. The thing that we're seeing a lot are things like monthly administrative fees or renewal fees or things like that. I actually the other day saw a fee that was a trash valet fee. Not exactly sure what that is. I believe that you're being handed copies of a type of lease that has a number of those fees highlighted in it. And so the idea is that tenant at the last minute is really forced to take this And in our view, this is a little bit of a bait and switch, that we believe that the rent ought to be the rent, and that if the landlord needs to have a higher rent, this is not a rent control bill. It's simply about saying really a full disclosure. And when you're looking at the actual advertising of the unit and talking to the tenant about the rent. And so that's really the purpose of that side of this bill. There will be another testifier that will give you some other firsthand experience on seeing these types of fees on a regular basis. This doesn't prohibit garage fees. It doesn't prohibit pet fees. It's really that these kind of administrative fees that are kind of thrown on that are really kind of rent disguised as something else. The other part of the bill deals with privacy. I've been representing landlords and tenants for about 35 years, probably 10,000 former clients if I did the math and added it all up. So I've seen a lot in this time. And we've had this privacy statute on the books for quite a while, and I think it was well-intentioned and well-drafted in the first place. Talked about reasonable notice, and I think it's sometimes good when you have an original bill to have some language that's maybe a little less precise to see how things play out over the years. But we've had enough experience to see that simply saying a reasonable notice is really left up to a lot of interpretation, and we hear stories from tenants all the time about the landlord says, I'll be over in 5 minutes, or maybe I'll be over in a minute. And there, and I'm not, this is not hyperbole, there have been tenants that have been had the knock on the door, and they're in the shower, or they're in the robe, or they're getting changing diapers on kids and things like that. So all this bill does is to say that instead of reasonable notice, that it needs to be a 24-hour notice, and it needs to have a time parameter in for when the landlord would then come to visit. We've had, there's one that we saw recently where the notice to the tenant was, I'll be over sometime in the next 20 days within a fairly lengthy parameter. And even those of us that are, I think, frustrated with having to hang around for the utility company or the internet company to come are not given that kind of a notice that it's going to be over that long period of time. So those are the principal things that are involved with this bill.
And Representative Herr, I think we're not hearing all the testifiers you have listed. So who would you like to bring forward? Is it Leanna Stefaniak and Cecil Smith? Or no?
Madam Chair, we'd like to call up Molly Hasbrook.
Molly Hasbrook.
Okay, my apologies. We do have a lot of people listed on here. Kendall Benson will be our next testifier, Madam Chair.
Kendall Benson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Kendall Benson, a unit manager in the Housing First Division at Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Catholic Charities served nearly 23,000 children, families, and adults over the course of 2019. Over the last 2 years, we experienced a 32% increase in clients seeking housing services, including emergency shelter and permanent housing. Thank you for this opportunity to share my experience with tenants and fees. So like I said, I'm the unit manager for Catholic Charities Scattered Site Housing Support Program in Ramsey County. So we partner with private market landlords to house homeless individuals in the community. Our program limits us to certain budgetary constraints, but overall we have the freedom to house anyone within Ramsey County. Once individuals are housed, we then provide ongoing case management services to ensure that they keep their housing for the long term. So in order to be a program participant, our clients have to meet the long-term homeless definition, meaning they have been homeless for at least one consecutive year. Our clients have no or very limited financial means. I am here in favor of House File 3348 and part of an experience just last week. We had finalized a lease with a landlord and we were going to sign that lease with our client. And when we met with the landlord, we were then told that there was a $150 administration fee that was due at lease signing. The case manager was not aware of this and then had to make arrangements to provide payment after the appointments was already set up, so this individual could not move into their unit and has thus remained homeless for the 3 to 4 days that We were figuring out how to process that administration fee. So if there was disclosure ahead of time, then the case manager would have been able to prepare these funds and ensure that the client would be housed as planned. I thank you very much for this opportunity to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, both will be watching for hands here, so you'll let me know if we have any questions. Yes, you have another testifier?
Madam Chair, I do. We have one more testifier, Molly Hasbrook.
Molly Hasbrook. I don't know how you timed that. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Molly Hasbrook. The apartment I currently rent was under control of disgraced slumlord Stephen Friends of Apartment Shop for the first 5 years I was a resident. While I experienced several concerning issues, ranging from no heat in a month, ranging from no heat for a month in a record-breaking winter season to relentless untreated pest infestations, the issue I'm here to speak to you about is something every tenant should have a legal right to, privacy. Countless times throughout the 5 years I rented from this man, my apartment was entered without notice and often without a valid reason. If a maintenance concern I reported were ever to be fixed, it was without notice, even when notice was specifically requested. A couple of times, I arrived home to a handwritten note that maintenance had been into my apartment to fix an issue I had never reported in the first place. Worse than that, at times I would come home to my apartment when someone had clearly been there for unknown reasons and not left any sort of notice as to why. A handful of times, I arrived home to my front door already unlocked, in spite of my diligence of double-checking the lock before I left due to the first occurrence. The faucet in my bathtub was once set to shower, though I had just had a bath that morning. Perhaps the most disturbing was the evidence left behind of someone having used my bathroom very recently before I arrived home. The last straw came after the class action lawsuit against my landlord began. The building was under control of a court-appointed administrator, but they hadn't yet switched out the maintenance crew. I had recently installed a chain that could be locked and loosened with a key from the outside in an effort to restore some privacy. One afternoon, I came home to a note from the head of apartment shop maintenance, Peter Friends, brother of Steve Friends, the very landlord I was suing, who had clipped the chain and entered my apartment while I wasn't home. It's nearly impossible to feel safe in your own home when you have no control over who enters it and when. I ask that you give us the protection that all people deserve with this bill, a reasonable right to privacy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have Mr. Smith? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I am President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We represent 1,900 members with over 320,000 units of housing in the state. I come today to raise concerns regarding House File 3348. If I understand the author's intent, it is not just opposition to fees, but the fact that some fees are a surprise at lease signing. My own recent experience purchasing a cell phone and a new contract brought this frustration home. No one likes an unexpected fee attached to their phone bill, just like no one would appreciate an unexpected fee attached to their rental. So I assume the issue isn't just the fees themselves. This is because if they are prohibited, then they would simply be included in the rental charge. Under this assumption, I would propose to the author and the committee that a fee disclosure bill would be in order and be the best practice and something that MHA could support in the interests of fair and transparent markets. Additionally, there are concerns that the effective date would run afoul of the Impairment of Contracts Act and possibly be unconstitutional. This also warrants further analysis. The next section of the bill outlines the 24-hour notice, which there are concerns about how this could function for property managers, and it would reduce efficiencies. There are several challenges to reasonable management practices. Two examples. The appliance delivery company reschedules the delivery window on the morning of delivery, bringing the desired new appliance to the resident. But under this bill, we would have to postpone the delivery to be in compliance after having given notice. This does not serve the interests of the resident. Another instance occurs when we are showing units after a resident has decided to leave. If the resident is asking to terminate the lease early, then ready access to the unit for immediate or short showings notice is in the resident's interest if they wish to be excused from their lease and a replacement resident take their apartment. Additionally, the language removes the word substantially from the statute. We find this troubling because it provides no flexibility. As an example, the property management entity could be penalized if they enter the apartment 7 minutes too early. The penalty outlined in the legislation provides for 1.5 months' rent, which does not seem to be consistent with the damages to the resident in the situation outlined. It also states a violation of the 24-hour rule violates the covenants of habitability, which itself comes with significant additional penalties. We feel this is overly broad and also not consistent with the damages incurred. Overall, both pieces of legislation simply do not account for how rental business operates and penalizes managers in a way which is disproportionate. Thank you.
I was just checking with our researcher whether, specifically, I think you referenced the effective date.
Yes.
Maybe just repeat that, and then I was going to ask for clarification from the researcher.
You want me to repeat my testimony?
The point about the effective date, I thought you said something.
So there's an impairments of contract issue because there are existing contracts in place.
You didn't use the word constitutional.
I used the word, so I said, there are concerns that the effective date would run afoul of the Impairments of Contract Act and be possibly unconstitutional. It warrants further analysis if there are existing leases already in place with the effective date.
Chair and members, I think what he's referring to is that the section effective date for these is that it applies to leases signed before, on, or after August 1st, 2020, so leases that are currently in place that might have some other provisions would be, those provisions might be unenforceable under this statute, but this... that could be changed if you decided to make it apply to leases signed on or after August 1st.
And the good news is this is going to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, so there's another opportunity. There's a lot of complexity there. Representative Hur, did you want to respond to any of your, maybe Mr. McDonough? To respond to any of the testimony?
Madam Chair, I did just have a quick comment, and I guess I just want to point out that comparing unexpected fees for housing to telephone is, to me, they're not analogous. Having a phone, though, is very important. It is not a right to have a phone, but being able to have housing, there is a right to that, and that the cost of housing and the fees charged to housing are much, much greater, and it actually prevents people from being able to get into homes when there are unexpected fees. And being able to put these fees into the cost of rent, that actually then shows somebody what their actual cost of rent is. And so I just wanted to point out that saying that in one industry because it's okay to do it means it should be okay, and that maybe we should just follow something. To me, it's just not, they're not analogous situations. And so I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you. I think we have no questions. So
thank you.
We have one more testifier, Ms. Lee.
Madam Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Thank you. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee. I head Virgin's Hope International, which does legal advocacy and policy. Our family centers are shelters, transitional home, and services, which includes housing and so healthcare and social services, and also APAC, which is a housing consortium. Since I will limit this to not only House File 3348 in one, but they kind of relate to 3349 and 1972, so I'll just say it once. When you talk about landlords, this also includes a government entity who takes a position, or a mortgage company which takes a position if there's unclear situations dealing with who the landlord actually is. And they have intervened, claiming they're on doing it on behalf of the state of Minnesota. And so some of these things, when you think of the terms, think of it in terms of what these entities can do against a so-called tenant. And in that case, you know, we are concerned about how some of the things impact. So, for example, when they talk about in section in 3349, they list a number of different things that are the responsibility of the so-called landlord. They also use that the city has powers to force a landlord to take care of these things, or it's considered illegal, punishable by misdemeanor, conviction, fine, and jail. And so we're concerned as far as how this is structured to prevent that type of thing from happening. And also with Representative Hassan's bill, that there are illegal violations that are made up by some of these city officials that also impact the tenants and then puts them on the reverse side of what you're trying to do to help them. But otherwise, we fully support all the bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Kerr, we have three questions, and I don't know if you want Mr. McDonough back at the table. And Bierman also.
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Mr. McDonough.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Hausman, I actually have a couple questions for the second testifier. Some of the comments you made, I want to get some clarification on that to make sure that it falls under this, her testimony falls under this bill.
That would be Kendall Benson.
Actually, my mistake. It's the lady sitting behind with the
Molly grease. Hasbro.
Chair Hausman.
Representative Johnson.
Ms. Hasbrook, you mentioned that you had somebody come into your apartment. They cut the chain. I'm suspecting you had chained your door or a gate closed so people could not enter. I'm just wondering if you ever found out who actually entered your apartment.
Yes, the head of maintenance, brother to the landlord that I was actually suing at the time, his brother and head of maintenance of apartment shop had cut my chain and entered my apartment.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Hausman, the chair Hausman, said, did you find out what the purpose was for entering your apartment?
The claim was that there was water damage downstairs. It was not an immediate concern to my knowledge. But that they were checking out a potential leak.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, Chair Hausman, well, if there's water damage, they need to find the leak, because what you can end up with was a serious mold issue, which could cause just about everybody in that apartment complex to have to be removed. So that would be an emergency situation to come in. So I don't think, unfortunately, I don't think that qualifies. If there's others, there is remedies. If you didn't know who it was, that a police report could have been made, because it could have been a burglary as well. Chair Hoffman, I also have another question for Representative Herr on this bill. I'm just wondering how this bill compares to the HUD regulations involving HUD housing, because there's special rules and regulations for giving notice, and I want to make sure, I'm just wondering if these mirror those those regulations, or is this is more stringent than the HUD regulations?
Is that to Representative Kerr or?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are actually going to have our respond to that.
Mr. McDonough.
Yes, Representative Johnson, there are a number of different HUD programs. I'm not sure if you're referring to like Section 8 voucher, public housing, or different ones. They have different requirements. Generally, the rules on preemption regarding HUD and state laws is that state laws are allowed to be more protective in areas like this. So if we have a state statute that says this is what the rule is, I don't see that we're going to have any conflict issues with the HUD.
Chair Osmond, I want to make sure that if we do something like this, it's done right. Affordable housing is a major issue. I just want to make sure that we're not causing issues where the increased costs are going to make rent go higher, make it less affordable. Some of the penalties in here, if there's going to be possibility of penalties, those are going to be added into the rent, increasing the rent. Do I want the tenants to have be safe and secure in their homes and not undue invasions for things? Absolutely. But as has been stated, there could be issues where this type of regulation for entering an apartment or for some of the fees, especially like garbage collection. I know there's times that because of situations, huge increase in those fees go up, and it was unexpected, and because of the things tied to the lease, it could affect that for the all of a sudden they can't pay the garbage fees, and all of a sudden the garbage is piling up. There's some things out of the landlord's control for costs, and those need to be looked at and be dealt with carefully. So I do have some current concerns. I think some of the ideas in here are good, but I think we need to really take a close look at it to make sure we don't make affordable housing unaffordable.
Representative Johnson, I have been a landlord myself off and on for about 35 years, and in terms of penalties leading to higher rents, I haven't seen that in my experience, that a landlord saying, well, because I violate this law all the time, I'm now going to increase my rent to kind of take care of that. When I look at this from a landlord's perspective, if I follow the policy, if I follow the privacy rule, for instance, which is now more clear, I mean, in the past, you know, what's reasonable notice? I mean, and you'd essentially have to litigate that issue. And I am a litigator, and I like litigating, but the idea that parties should have to litigate, you know, among 300 judges throughout Minnesota to figure out what's a reasonable notice, I don't think is the way we ought to go. And if I have clarity as a landlord that I need to say that I need to follow these privacy rules, then I don't have any penalties. And I look at this bill in particular, and from a landlord's perspective, I think it's pretty easy to follow. In my lease, I just say what my rent is, and I don't have a bunch of administrative charges. And I simply follow the privacy rules. I have a 24-hour notice, I have a window for visits. I can deal with that. In terms of showing apartments, when I've had to do that, that hasn't been something that I arrange at the last minute, like 5 minutes. That's something where I'll talk to someone, they want to look at an apartment, and so we'll figure out a time, you know, a day or two down the road. It's very easy for me to comply with the statute and show that apartment.
Members, we have Representative Howard, Tice, Munson, and Bierman. Just so you know, you are all on the list. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill forward. And I wanted to thank Mrs. Hasbrook for her testimony. I think it speaks to, for all of us, whether we're a renter or a homeowner, I don't think any of us want to feel that invasion of privacy. And my question is either for the bill author or the testifier, is there anything in this bill that, in terms of the, we can recognize there may be some immediacy beyond the 24 hours, but is there anything in this bill that prevents a landlord from contacting the tenant and making sure they're aware of it and allowing the landlord to come, you know, in a window before that 24 hours?
Representative Howard, 2 points. For emergencies, the statute already says that the landlord can come without any kind of prior notice for an emergency and then leave a note saying that they did come. And so this does nothing to stop emergency responses. This also doesn't prohibit the landlord from saying, you know, it'd really be great if I could come over at 5 o'clock this afternoon, tenant, you're okay with that. There's nothing that prevents the tenant from doing this. This is really getting it more at involuntary visits from the landlord, the landlord simply saying, I'm coming, and that's it.
Thank you.
Representative Pice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just have a couple questions, and I'm not sure who basically will take care of it. But I do have a, being a landlord, we have had some costs that come, and I'm looking at the $25 monthly trash valet, which it says there was an attached addendum that explained what that was. For us in the city of St. Cloud, our city went from a bag system for rentals to a trash container for both garbage and recycling, which was a big difference for us. Before, it was one way that our tenants could take care of their garbage because they had to buy the bags. To all of a sudden, we have to pay $25 a month for two container for the containers. And that's something we took care of because we could. We were doing it, we didn't have all of them doing it at the same time, which is a big deal. I mean, then I'm looking at $125, $150 a month extra for some of these things. It is a way for us to recoup, especially if there is a lease addendum explaining what it was. And then I do have some issues with this lease signed before on 1.16. Some of those leases could have been signed 8, 9, 10 months before, and to have them retroactive really doesn't seem legal. I mean, we don't see a lot of these things coming, and that's why we have to add some of this stuff. But that one just really concerns me. And I do agree with our testifier, Cecil Smith, that substantially really kind of makes my hair stand up, taking that out. There are times we don't have a management company take care of our apartments. It's us, mostly my husband. And he does have another job. We do have another business. And so his time is a little bit limited. And very seldom has he ever, in fact, I'm having a hard time. But if an emergency comes up, if somebody calls and says something's happening and he has to go to that unit, it just kind of makes a landlord leery. If a neighbor calls and said, hey, we're noticing something, and yet I realize it's an emergency and it probably would be an exception, but we just had somebody hit the garage. And not that we need to necessarily go in the house, but the garage is attached. And so I'm looking at some of these things that have come up. We had a tenant who had a mouse. It was a big emergency to her. But again, it's got to be on what my husband's schedule is. And yes, they did work it out. But sometimes he doesn't always have that notice. Sometimes it's like, well, if I have time, I'll just stop by. And I'm just worried some of those things might get a little muddy with some of this language as well. So I just want to express my concerns. It's tough to be a landlord too. Not all tenants are good tenants. We've been extremely fortunate. But some days it is a two-way street. And I want to watch out too for folks who might be looking for a situation to abuse something. Thank you.
Representative.
It occurs to me that a number of these comments, if you're taking notes, that I'm sure will be addressed further also in judiciary finance and civil law, I'm guessing. I think these were comments and advice that I heard. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have concerns around this bill, specifically, you know, when you're putting the time frame of when a landlord can enter. I want to be just ask a clarifying question. So when you talk about the landlord may not enter between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., that really only applies because of the last sentence, 2.2 and 2.3, where it says that you're that it's a condition of entering into or maintaining the lease. It isn't saying that they can't enter outside of those hours. It's saying the landlord can't force a tenant to, you know, show their apartment at 9 p.m., right? Is that right? That it's
Mr. McDonough.
Representative Munson, yes.
Okay.
The tenant could agree to it.
The tenant can agree to it. Because I was concerned around the statement of saying a residential tenant may not waive that right. Because I have tenants that work nights. I have, you know, rental properties around a hospital where there's a lot of people that work nights, and it just so happens that it's best for them to see the apartment or show the apartment at 9 p.m. And so as long as we're allowing the tenant to waive the right, that's important. We also frequently pay tenants a fee, like, hey, we want to get the property leased, and, you know, if you keep up, if you clean your property and be more, you know, allow for a shorter period of showing time to show the apartment on, you know, notice less than 24 hours, that you're still allowed to do that under this provision. Is that right?
Yes. And Representative Munson, I mean, I get, and also Representative Tice, I mean, I have a day job. I'm an attorney. I have a night job. I'm a jazz pianist, and I've been a landlord. And so that scheduling is hard when you have other things, when you're not a full-time landlord. There isn't anything that prohibits a tenant from saying, yes, let's do this then. The non-waiver stuff has to do with the landlord can't say, well, it's part of my lease. We're just waiving this requirement that I have to give you notice. So the involuntary aspect of visits cannot be waived, but the tenant can voluntarily say, sure, let's do this at 9 o'clock.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, it's the follow-up question. So at the beginning, as on line 119, where it says, except as provided in subdivision 5, which isn't in this bill, but I looked up the statute here, and my understanding is it says subdivision 5 is entry without residential tenant's presence. If the landlord enters when the residential tenant is not present and the prior notice has not been given, the landlord shall disclose the entry by placing a written disclosure of the entry in a conspicuous place in the premise. It doesn't say restrict the reasons why it's a landlord can enter. As far as I'm reading this, I'm not an attorney, but it seems like it takes a lot of teeth out of this provision by just saying if the landlord does violate this, that they just have to leave a notice. What am I missing here? That I mean, if I'm in a property and there's no water at a unit, and I'm wondering, did the tenant in the, you know, in the next property, if the water runs through it or whatever, did they shut it off? And I need to go check to see. I need to get access to the property, and I know they're working, and they know they keep their dog locked up in a, you know, kennel, so I can enter the property to check on the water supply. My other tenant thinks it's an emergency. That I would like to be able to go into the property, but if I leave a note saying I came into the property to check this, but it's fine, is that still allowing me to get out of this, or is this provision not apply?
Mr. McDonough.
Representative Munson, that provision does apply to emergencies.
As defined by who?
Representative Munson.
As defined by whom?
Well, the statute doesn't lay out all the things that can be emergencies. In my experience, I haven't had a case where the tenant said when the landlord came for an emergency that it wasn't an emergency. Now, I could certainly envision a landlord, you know, most landlords are fine, but I also deal with the slumlord community and they're not fine. I could certainly see someone claiming something to be an emergency when it wasn't, but I have not seen that in my experience. So that provision is for to get immediate access for emergencies, but then to leave a note saying I was here for that.
Okay. So and as an example, instead of using the water, let's just use power, because there's properties where maybe a electrical panel is in one property, in one unit that supplies power to multiple, and the breaker tripped. And it's an emergency because this tenant can't, you know, do whatever they have to do, dry their hair or whatever. So I can't wait 24 hours to go in and check the breaker. So this provision here in subdivision 5 doesn't say anything about an emergency. It just says if the landlord enters, you know, without proper notice, that they have to leave a note in a conspicuous place. I just feel like if it's at risk of losing an entire month's rent, because that's the violation now, that's frustrating to the landlords. And now you're going to, you know, the other tenant's going to be upset because they don't have utilities to their unit for 24 hours. I just think it's an overreach with this thing. And I understand there's bad landlords out there, but this is a provision that impacts all landlords. and I just think it goes too far.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill forward. My questions actually have been addressed by the previous questions and answers we've had, so that's been good discussion. I think the bottom line, it reinforces to me the fact that we all know the best way to keep good tenants and happy landlords is communication, clarity and transparency, and I think this bill helps us get to that point. It is, as Representative Tice said, always a two-way street. And so people who have been landlords know that, and we want the best for the tenants as well. I did have an issue in my own district this summer whereby a tenant was being harassed repeatedly by a landlord to gain access into his apartment, and there was really no good cause for it, according to the tenant. You know, I hadn't spoken to the landlord at that time, but it lent credence to the issue that one of the ways to turn tenants away from landlords is to show up at 8 o'clock in the evening and say, "Can I come in and check out the property? I just want to make sure things are up to date for you." And you know, he had family time with his kids, and he said no, and it began to plant a seed that turned bad. And I think that this sort of 24-hour notice would be good. But I like that my question was in regards to being able to contact a tenant and saying, can we come in sooner? So that was addressed by Rep. Howard. So thank you for that. Short showings, which Mr. Smith addressed, I think falls into the same bucket. If a tenant wants to move out and it's in his interest to show the property, he would be open to that, and I wanted to make sure that that was addressed in the bill that they could, and you've done a great job at that. So no further questions at this time. Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling to find where even within what is in statute and what is proposed, where that permission being granted by the tenant is actually, I understand if there's no dispute, right? But where in statute is it that I can get permission from my tenant to enter the premises?
Mr. McDonough?
Representative Pearson, it's not in the statute, but it's really the case in all the landlord-tenant statutes that we have here that we don't have that kind of language. If we were to add that language here, then we'd need to really start looking at everything in 504B and figure out where we need to have those things in there. All that's prohibited here in terms of, I mean, we have certain conduct and there's a prohibition on waiver, but there's no, and again, this statute is dealing with the landlord simply saying this is when I'm going to come to visit. There isn't anything in the statute that prohibits the landlord and tenant to agree on a time for a visit. And that would be the same for a lot of our landlord-tenant statutes. You know, if the landlord says, I need 23 days to return a security deposit rather than 21 days, and ask the tenant if that's okay, and the tenant says that's okay, then it's okay.
Follow?
Yes. This will be a while, probably.
We do have quite a few bills, so.
Well, then we shouldn't bring bills that take this much time or need this much work. Madam Chair,
going to another committee.
I appreciate that. I won't be at the other committee, Madam Chair. So we've got a restriction here that says that not less than 24 hours. And yet if I call a tenant and the tenant says, yeah, go ahead, check it out at 5. In that situation, the statute reads that I wasn't allowed to do that. And I'm in violation. And that tenant could get 1 month's free rent if they determine that that was a problem later. And then within that, you're also saying that that they're not allowed to waive that even in maintaining the lease, not just entering the lease, but maintaining the lease. So, you know, it's this whole idea that the tenant is in this position of weakness and not able to negotiate on their own behalf. So how could they not later say that they were manipulated into agreeing to that 5 o'clock appointment and then getting a 3 months rent out of that type of a because there's nothing in statute that limits that or protects the landlord.
Mr. McDonough.
Representative Pearson, you know, I guess a judge would have to be convinced by a tenant that that actually was the case. I mean, from a landlord's perspective, what I would do is I would say, here's a 24-hour notice to do this thing. It would be nice if we could actually meet at 5 o'clock today. Are you okay with that? And if the tenant came back and said, fine, let's meet at 5, I think I'm in compliance with the statute.
I don't view the statute in that same way. I see no protection for the landlord in that situation. The statute's explicit. You have to give of not less than 24 hours notice in advance. And then further, that the tenant can't be essentially asked to waive that in any way in maintaining the lease. That's on line 2.2. So I don't know that I quite feel the confidence that you give that in reading the statute, and I think this is a very bad idea that puts tenants in a stronger position than the landlords and could be manipulated in a lot of situations for a free month of rent just by verbally agreeing to something and then not having to deliver on it. So I think the statute is a reverse penalty on landlords.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several of my questions had already been answered by the testifiers, but the one thing I did want to mention here that's very important is too often we've got the bad actors out there that are taking advantage of populations that are primarily lower income and primarily people of color. Too often I've seen, particularly with the additional fees being added on when we've been working with youth that have been homeless, where surprise things come up and you're left scrambling, and in some instances it delays, as we heard from the testimony, not only the person getting into the apartment, but sometimes prevents them from getting housing. And with the tight market we have, the slumlords are able to continue doing this out there. I've had experience where I've been out to some of these buildings that were supposedly advertised as security buildings, and the locks are missing and the outside doors. You get inside, you find that the locks are missing inside, and the people are so intimidated. When I've talked to them, they said, I don't report anything because they're going to force me out of the building. And this is not your typical landlord. I know that the folks that we have normally do great things, but we're trying to address situations where are very horrifying. And I think what we've heard on the privacy issue falls in that category. People should have the right to expect reasonable privacy within their own homes. And we've heard instances where that is not occurring. And privacy is one of the most important things that we have here in our country. We want to make sure that we're protecting that. And I think that this bill is getting to that issue. And I want to thank the author for bringing the bill forward.
Representative Herr, you've brought a bill that attempts to have us discuss the power balance. What's the right power balance between landlord and tenant? And that's been reflected in our discussion, I think, this morning. Do you have any closing comments?
I do, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to address a couple of concerns really quickly, that this bill has been out there for a couple of weeks. I haven't been here long enough to form opinions about people or departments or organizations. I'm always really open to any suggestions. I actually brought a couple of my bills in housing to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle and asked them for their opinion, and we actually made a couple changes because of that. My intention with bills is never to pit people against each other, to pit tenants and landlords against each other. My parents actually have been landlords. They actually had properties that were also Section 8 properties, and they've also rented commercial properties and properties that were their homes. And I see both sides of the argument, and that I'm always open to some good suggestions, because again, this is really trying to, when we're too prescriptive with laws and we say exactly what is considered, an emergency, what is not, what is, some of the other language here around like what is substantial and what is not, we get a lot of pushback for that. But then when we leave it broadly, we get a lot of pushback for not being more specific. And I would love to actually see some solutions around that and not just using some of these words to fight against each other. And so I'm really open to whatever suggestions, as some of these people will not be at the next stop. My door is open for anyone to provide suggestions about what they think could make this bill better. And I did take a couple of suggestions away from Representative Tice that we'll definitely work with the advocates on this, just to see if we can tighten up the language a bit. But I do appreciate the discussion today. I do hope that the committee supports House File 3348.
Representative Herr renews her motion that House File 3348, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. 3348 is on its way to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Thank you very much. We're going to give you a break, and we're going to go to Representative Zahn. Members, because all of these bills have to go to Judiciary, we do, just because of the committee deadlines, we have reserved 1:20 in the state capitol if this hearing goes over our regular committee time at 5 p.m. today. So hopefully we'll move as quickly as we can.
Chair Hausman.
Representative Johnson.
Unfortunately, 5 p.m. will not work. That is slated time for caucuses, and we cannot have committee hearings during that time.
We have it all evening, so we'll check on that. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Representative Zahn.
Would you like to move your bill, Madam Chair? Yes, Madam Chair. I move House File 1972 to be referred to Judiciary.
And you also have an author's amendment, I believe, to get the bill before us. You have a delete all?
Yes.
Would you like to move the DE3?
Yes, I move the DE3, Madam Chair.
And do you want to speak broadly to that?
It's an amendment that gets the bill in the shape that the author wanted.
The DE3 is before us. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? That is before us, the DE3.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. Thank you for hearing House File 1972, which pertains to pre-eviction notice to tenants. With housing instability being a challenge for many Minnesotans, we must do absolutely everything possible to remove barriers that prevent folks from having a stable place to call home. Housing instability affects having stable employment, education, health, and all other areas of life. More than 13,000 evictions are filed in Minnesota every year, and mostly impacting communities of color, low-income communities, single mothers, and indigenous communities. It's our responsibility to find answers to combat this issue. What this legislation does is, before bringing an eviction action for a non-payment, this bill would require landlords to provide a written notice to residential tenants specifying the basis for future eviction action. This notice must include a total amount due, a specific accounting of that total, unpaid rent, late fees, and other charges, the name and address of anyone authorized to receive the payment. I used to work for Hennepin County as the social worker, and it takes about 14 days for somebody 21 days for Hennepin County and 14 days for Ramsey County for somebody who's applying for emergency assistance. And we also, Hennepin County, and I think all the counties require to have a letter from your landlord that says you are being affected for you to get to access emergency assistance dollars. So what this bill would do is help tenants as well as landlords to work together if somebody lost their job, if there is some financial difficulties that they can't pay their rent. It would allow them to work with their landlord to get a letter from them that says you will be affected, and use that letter to maybe expedite their case in the county or their other resources, whether they're getting money from family members, other social service entities. This would actually allow both parties to work together to find a solution to a problem. And most evictions, as we know, are filed because of non-payment. More than 90% of them are filed non-payment. I have here with me Larry McDowell, who will also explain the bill to us.
Mr. McDonough, welcome back.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, so what this bill does is has a 14-day notice requirement for the landlord for non-payment of rent. This is analogous, very similar to the type of notice that a tenant would have to give if the tenant were going to file an action against the landlord, a rent escrow action, to have repairs done or to enforce provisions of the lease. So it's really a mirror image requirement as compared to that. And my experience as a landlord, and when I say as a landlord, I don't want to overblow that, not a landlord with like a million properties, essentially renting out single-family dwellings from time to time. In my experience, the giving of a notice that I didn't have to give, but I gave, resolved problems and didn't require me to go to court. In my experience, and there are other types of, certainly some landlords that have used these types of notice requirements, and in my experience, they file less eviction cases because the notice prompts the conversation, resolves the problem. I'm not saying that that's going to happen in all cases, but it's certainly the idea behind this is not to simply extend an eviction process. You know, someone might say, well, this is just going to give the tenant an extra 14 days to not pay the rent. You know, there certainly may be situations like this, but in my experience, when tenants have notices to move out or do something, they do that. Now, there's certainly some that don't, but the number of evictions that you have when a landlord in a month-to-month tenancy gives a one-month notice and then has to file an eviction after the tenant moves out, the numbers of those evictions are just minuscule. And I think that is because the tenant's gotten that type of notice and has that ability to respond. Now, this is a little bit different than that. It's a shorter notice, but it's concerning a specific issue, which is non-payment of rent. In my experience, when this type of notice has been given, it leads to a couple of different results in the majority. And the minority would be the eviction case. And the majority would be the tenant and the landlord have a conversation. The tenant maybe gets some help from emergency assistance or for family or for friends, and they resolve the problem, or they work out a payment plan with the landlord, or they take a hard look at their finances and they realize, you know, this place is not affordable. I'm going to use this time to move out. You might be thinking, well, is the tenant really going to move or not? Well, some might not, but most do when they have notices because they understand that eviction records follow people around. That wasn't the case 35 years ago when I started doing this kind of work, but in an electronic age it is. If you file an eviction case against me today, it's going to be something that the landlord community and the public can find out within just a few days. Now, one critical thing that we have in here is related to emergency assistance. And some landlords have told us, you know, man, I wish things would get faster with emergency assistance. I want to keep renting to this tenant. I know this tenant has an emergency, but emergency assistance isn't going to work fast enough. I can't wait. And so a couple things we have in here is to have this notice meet some of the requirements for emergency assistance so that it will shorten up that process. It will verify the amount of the debt. It will verify that there is indeed a fact, an emergency, and that moves that process faster rather than having the county have to reach out to the landlord and say, hey, can you verify this? Can you tell me that this really is an emergency?
I think we'll get the next testifier up. Well, I think we have three more people. Maybe we'll get to them quickly and
good morning, Madam Chair, committee members.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Akua Ellis, and I'm Senior Vice President of Community Impact at the Greater Twin Cities United Way. I'm here to support or speak in support of House File 1972. You know, at the Greater Twin Cities United Way, our mission is to build pathways toward prosperity and equity for all. And we touch over 500,000 lives a year in that work. We fund over 100 service organizations through grant making across our three impact areas, which include household stability, educational success, and economic opportunity. Through our work, we know that a stable home is the foundation that enables Minnesotans to thrive, supporting our vision that homelessness and hunger are rare, brief, and non-recurring. Yet many of our families struggle to access and maintain stable housing, with more than 13,000 evictions filed across the state each year. As a result, our nonprofit partners often find themselves addressing the impacts of these evictions. Following an eviction, many families can spiral into crisis, including unemployment, lower educational achievement for their children, and negative health outcomes. All too often, an eviction can ultimately lead to homelessness. statewide, one-third of adults who are experiencing homelessness or who were experiencing homelessness in 2015 attributed their circumstances to a previous eviction. But many of these evictions are avoidable. In fact, 93% of evictions are due to non-payment of rent, which has been expressed a moment ago, and can be settled successfully out of court if tenants have adequate time to apply for emergency financial assistance. However, in Minnesota, landlords are not required to provide tenants any notice before filing an eviction lawsuit, which is a requirement in all but a handful of states across the union. We can do something about that today. Given that tenants are required to allow landlords 14 days to address issues of habitability, we believe the same level of grace should be extended to tenants. Eviction prevention is homelessness prevention. I want to say that again. Eviction prevention is homelessness prevention, and it's a lot cheaper to prevent homelessness than to respond to it. And it's an important way to strengthen our state. Enacting House File 1972 is one tool that will move our state in the right direction. So I would encourage you and ask that you would consider House File 1972, supporting it, and modernizing Minnesota's eviction process. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. We have Michelle Duran.
I'm surprised I'm not Michelle. My name is Eric Haugi. I'm the executive director of Homeline. To save the committee's time, I'll just submit a copy of Michelle's testimony. Okay. She signed up last week and had hoped to come here today, but unfortunately, as a result of the eviction that's on her record, she was not able to secure her housing choice over the weekend, and so she's living in a weekly rental right now, very unstable housing situation. And so this bill would have prevented the eviction that was filed against her. And I'll submit, I just have one copy.
And we'll make copies of that for all of the committee members. Thank you very much. And then we have Joe Abram. Welcome. Please identify yourself.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Joe Abraham. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on the proposed bill. I own and manage 750 apartments in the metro area, the majority of which are naturally occurring affordable housing. And I'm here today to speak in opposition to the proposal. So first, I'd like to share a little data to put the topic of eviction in perspective and give you a little context. The data originates from Matthew Desmond and the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. It's a widely respected national expert on this topic. The state of Minnesota ranks 46th of 50 states in the rate of evictions. Our eviction rate has consistently been lower and fallen faster and further than the national rate for each of the past 10 years. And there are five states that require a 14-day advance notice for non-payment, in each of which they have a higher rate of evictions than the state of Minnesota. Evictions are expensive, they're disruptive, and it's the best interest of all parties if we can avoid them. The overwhelming majority of property owners provide flexibility to comply with payment terms. This includes things like grace periods, very soft reminders, and a genuine interest to do anything reasonable to keep customers in our communities, in our properties. This legislation would limit a property owner's ability to offer informal resolution to residents. So I'd like to provide you a summary of description of how my company handles late payments, and while exact details, you know, will differ from owner to owner, this should provide a pretty clear picture of a typical industry practice. At 6 days following a late payment, a friendly reminder is sent. This might say something like, I'm sure it's an oversight on your part, but your rent is 6 days late. The second incident will be 10 to 15 days, typically without a communication from the resident or reply. A second notice would be sent, kind of a little bit more. We sent you a notice on the 6th or the 7th. We're reminding you again, we still haven't heard from you. We've tried to reach you. It's important to know that during this process, we're consistently trying to reach that resident through phone call, text, email, post office, whatever method they've preferred, and any way that we have the ability to get a hold of them. At 21 to 24 days, usually a final notice is sent, and in there we will reference an eviction. I'm in the business to keep customers whenever possible. I'm not interested in emptying my apartments. These are customers, and we're the provider of housing to them. I intend to treat them with respect like any good business operator would. And accelerating an adversarial relationship with my customers is just not good business. More importantly, I value my reputation. I take great pride in providing clean, safe, well-maintained homes to thousands of our state's residents. Thank you for listening. My opportunity to speak today is, of course, a little bit limited, but I'm always willing to engage and answer any questions about our business in an effort to provide a better environment for renters of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And this will also be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law, so there will be another opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have no questions to the bill's author or Representative Pearson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was still trying to review some of this, and I apologize. I ended up going back to Rochester tonight for a real estate transaction showing of my own, so I didn't have time to fully vet this morning's bills, and so I'm sorry if I'm a little scattered this morning. The specific statute that we're dealing with is terminating tenancy at will. Can you give me the distinction between, because some of the testimony again this morning seems to be geared towards residential tenants, and here we're talking tenancy at will. Can you describe to me your maybe a few examples of what tenancy at will incidences would be in the state of Minnesota at this time?
Mr. McDonough.
Representative Pearson, perhaps there's a little confusion because that's the first part of this bill. Mm-hmm. What this bill really does is it takes one sentence out of that statute and adds some language in another statute. The tenancy at will is essentially like a month-to-month tenancy. And what that has and what the law about notice there is if we have a month-to-month tenancy and the rent's due on a monthly basis and I want to end that tenancy for any reason or no reason at all, I have to give you a one-month written notice. Now, if I want to terminate that tenancy based on non-payment of rent, I have to give a 14-day notice. Now, you might be wondering, well, why are we taking a 14-day notice out of one statute and putting it into another statute? What the case law has to say, and I'll do this very briefly because you don't want to talk about case law, but what the so what the case law says is that with a month-to-month tenancy, the 14-day notice there terminates the tenancy, but it doesn't provide a right of redemption for the tenant. And our plan and our idea behind having a notice provision in this other statute was to not eliminate the right of redemption. So that's why the 14-day notice comes out of one statute and we're putting it into another. Sorry about the confusion, but where things are placed in statutes is important.
Well, sir, thank you, Madam Chair. And you've done a great job giving one example of my understanding of what one example of tenancy at will would be. But a tenancy at will could be a much shorter term as well. And this statute really could be something that's applied to a weekly tenancy. And so by changing this in the tenancy at will clause, you really make it difficult for other landlords who do manage their practice in a different way, especially for people who aren't paying rent on a weekly unit to be evicted more swiftly and quickly. And I guess I'm just wanting to make sure that we're not just trying to make the assumption that all tenancy at will is on a monthly basis or a longer term than a month, and there are the shorter term instances that this could impact.
Representative Pearson, to be clear, with a at-will tenancy, you're right. It could even be a day-to-day tenancy or a week-to-week tenancy. Those are quite uncommon outside of the shelter world, but they do exist in very small numbers. This doesn't really impact that because any type of at-will tenancy under 504B135, if you wanted to terminate that tenancy for non-payment of rent, would have to be a 14-day notice, whether it was a week-to-week tenancy or a month-to-month tenancy. So this really doesn't impact that issue. What this really is intended to do is to have less evictions, and evictions should not, in my view, just personally be something that people rush to do because it has a lot of collateral consequences besides just whether someone is evicted or whether rent is collected. The idea behind this is to really engage a conversation that will lead to less evictions, and we really think this will do this. In my experience in this state, when landlords are giving that type of notice, you have lower levels of evictions. And one other thing in terms of the comment of the other testifier about this being adversarial, there isn't anything in the statute that requires this notice to be adversarial. I mean, it can be, the text of this notice can be written in very friendly terms. It's just saying, but this is the notice. It has to say a few things. But this notice can be drafted in a friendly way as opposed to a nasty way.
Representative Johnson?
Chair Hausman, Representative, on line 2.25, it talks about the notice can be sent by first class mail. Is that going by the date it was postmarked or the date it was received? It was a 14-day time period.
Mr. McDonough?
My reading of the, sorry, Representative Thompson, my reading of it would be the day of mailing, not the date of receipt.
Chair Hausman, it's what helped a little bit. I'm just thinking back to an incident I had just a couple months ago. I mailed out a bunch of letters, and I knew the people well. I know their addresses. 33 days later, I got about 14 of them back as undeliverable. Last week, I received one of the same letters returned as undeliverable. Now we're talking months, and you only had 14 days. And you're going to have to prove your 14 days that you mailed it, so you're going to have to do a receipt with certified with return signature receipt to prove that it was actually sent there, because when you do normal paper service, law enforcement has to document that service was made. And now you're extending basically for those few individuals that just don't want to pay their rent and they're looking for somewhere else, you are giving them probably a free 2 months of rent before they actually do the eviction. There's a lot of evictions I've actually had to serve them. And we had more than one that before we finally, law enforcement had to go and physically remove the person, it was over 90 days. You're looking three plus months of somebody not paying rent, and now you're giving them more time. I think most landlords do the right thing, do what needs to be done. They want to keep their units rented. They want to make sure that they're safe. Unfortunately, we have a few, and the way it sounds like, because everything is talking about the metro area, because we don't have these problems in greater Minnesota that I'm aware of. We're always talking about the metro, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where these problems are occurring. I guess I'd like to know why we're having those problems in the metro area. You don't need to respond to that.
Representative Howard has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess first, just a comment to Representative Johnson's point about missed addresses. I'm not a landlord, but I would assume most landlords know the address of their tenants. I guess my first question is, there was some reference to other states having something on the books like this. Could you respond to that? Are we proposing something here that other states have implemented, or something that's we're the first state to do it, or if you could.
And to that question, Mr. McDonough, in the interim, I had occasion to be on a panel at the Mitchell Hamilton Law School at their mediation center. And on that particular day, one of the mediators said, in fact, 43 states allow more time between notice and eviction than we do. I've been meaning to check that fact, whether that was the case, but that was a surprising comment to me. I see somebody saying, yes, that is the case.
Representative Howard and Representative Hausman, yes, that is the case. So we are not creating something brand new here. This is something that most states have. And also to say again, this is the same kind of notice that the tenant would have to give if the tenant says, I need some repair problems. If I have repair problems as a tenant that are non-emergency, I have to give a 14-day notice. And the reason for that is to give the landlord time to respond to that. Now, one could say, well, the landlord ought to know that there's disrepair, so they shouldn't have to have any time. But I think that is a good thing, that the landlord has the time to figure that out, get things done, and maybe work things out with a tenant. This is simply the flip side of it, and it's something that's done in other states and successfully.
We have no further questions. Do you have concluding comments? The author.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for listening to the testimony of House File 1972. I just want to highlight that we are trying, what we're trying to do here is not something new. Minnesota is one of the only seven states that don't require a notice of eviction. Evictions are expensive both for tenants and landlords, and they hunt tenants for 7 or more years. And we are in a housing crisis. This will help at least for some people that they don't get evictions filed on them. I know many folks that I've worked with in the past in my housing consultant career that they didn't even know that eviction was filed on them until they get a letter from a court that saying that you have to appear in court. So if we were to have this legislation, it would prevent that from happening. If people get a letter that says you have 14 days to pay rent or eviction will be filed, I am sure most people will react that positively and find means and ways to resolve that issue. And I thank you for taking up House File 1972, and I ask for your support.
Representative Hassan renews her motion that House File 1972, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
Bill is on its way. And Representative Herr, I think we'll start with it, and we need to conclude by 9:30, but we'll get going on House File 3349. If you have any of your testifiers, for example, that couldn't come back this evening, welcome once again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to be brief with this one. I feel like
you're going to first of all move your.
Yes, I would like to move House File 3349 to be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, would you like me to go over the A1 real briefly?
Yes, please.
The A1 is actually it's adding language to Section 2, Section 504B.375. There's no striking of any language. There's just addition of, if you look at the back page, lines 2.13 to 2.14, addition of the court's ability to waive fees.
That amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. That amendment is added to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just do a quick opening and turn this over to Mr. McDonough.
Because we have 10 minutes, if there's a testifier for whom it would be difficult to come back, could we perhaps just make sure that...
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have one other testifier, and it would be great to have her be able to testify as well. And so the House File 3349 is much more prescriptive than the last one. I tried to identify, there's two issues that we want to deal with, and it's with the minimum heat code for apartments and addressing emergency repairs promptly. That first, regarding the heat, when tenants rent their apartments, that they ought to be able to expect their unit is well heated. And then the second is the issue concerns getting emergency repairs made promptly and adding a handful of circumstances that could be explicitly added as emergencies. And if you've had a chance to look through the bill, there is specific items listed as to what would constitute some of these terms of emergency. And so since the last one wasn't prescriptive enough, I'm hoping that this gives us the foundation of discussion around the details of that. With that said, I would like to turn this over to my first testifier, which is Pastor Becky Hansen.
Thank you. Welcome. And we've seen some publicity about activity at Elam Church and your response. So welcome.
Well, good morning. Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Pastor Becky Hansen. I've served at Elam Church in Northeast Minneapolis for 20 years now. 13 years ago, we had the privilege of starting an outreach into the community of those experiencing homelessness. So today, we continue that work on a weekly basis. We also have a drop-in center, and we are running two cold weather temporary shelters at Elam and the church next door, Strong Tower, which is a Nigerian church. In the course of a week, we will have 300 encounters with individuals who come into the church for help and for sustenance and compassion. I also manage a rental home in North Minneapolis where I have five men living who are gentlemen that over the course of their lives would not be able to pass a background check. And that is important to me to weigh their past against who they are today, and they're wanting to achieve a different future. Elam and Hope Avenue are members of MICA, Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. MICA works in an amazing and an intentional way, without exception, so that everybody has safe, decent, accessible, and affordable housing. And I'm here today because I support House File 3349, the Emergency Tenant Remedy Action Bill, and other tenant protection bills. To have a safe and a decent place to live, people here in Minnesota must have water, must have hot water, sanitary facilities, electricity, working appliances, and heat. These are not extravagances. These are basic needs. A woman that I worked with through Hope Avenue was so proud to get into an apartment over in North Minneapolis, and she came to me and complained that her apartment was cold. Two of the men from the church and I went over to the apartment, and we found out that the ductwork was not attached to the furnace. Her building was frigid. She complained to her landlord, and she was evicted. She did not know her rights, and unfortunately, we don't teach landlord-tenant law in the schools anymore. As people of faith, we believe that how you treat the least of these is how we treat our God. In my scripture in the Bible, it says in James 2:6 that we disrespect the poor. But if our eyes drop down to verse 8, it says that when we live by the royal law and we love people as ourselves, we do right. Please pass House File 3349. It will provide greater protections to our community members and ensure that their unit, their housing, will be safe and decent for them. It's the right thing to do.
Thank you, Pastor Hanson.
Thank you.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, and I would like to bring down next testifier, Mr. McDonough. And I just wanted, before he goes into talking through the details of this, that we are not the first to look at having minimum heating. And so as we kind of, I want to make sure that that is the context that we're having this conversation with. And Minneapolis has been doing it for over a decade. Cities within the state have already been doing this. And so with that, I will turn it over to Mr. McDonough to walk through the details.
Mr. McDonough.
Thank you, Chairperson Houseman. So this bill has a number of components to it. They all relate to habitability issues. This is something that's very close to my heart because I worked on some of these original laws. I'm old enough to have done that, actually. So the Emergency Tenant Remedies Action came out of the Governor's Commission on Affordable Housing in 1988-1989, and I was proud to be part of that process. So the first component is to have a minimum heat. I think a requirement of 68 during the winter months, have it be a statewide issue. This is something that a lot of us take for granted when we have our own homes and can control our own heat. For those that don't, it's a big issue. And it's an issue across the state. This is something that, to be honest, is more rural than more urban, because we have in Minneapolis and St. Paul, we have those minimum heat requirements already. This is something that is really pretty fundamental to folks. I actually can adjust to a number of different types of heats. I'm one of those idiots that runs when it's 10 below and stuff. But that's my choice. To have this minimum heat and is really something that's quite fundamental for folks. So that's one aspect of the bill. Some of you might be thinking, well, we have a state building code that covers it. All the code requires statewide is that there be capacity to heat at 68. It doesn't require that the heat actually be at 68. So that's the big thing that this adds. Second, in the Emergency Tenant Remedies Action, there are a couple of components, actually three components that are there. One is to be more specific about what constitutes an emergency. And again, I'm proud of this legislation as originally enacted, and having just a smaller list of emergencies with a catch-all of other things that might come up, I think was appropriate at that time. Now, this many years later, to see that there are quite a few things that in my view and in the view of Homeline and Homes for All, are emergencies that aren't delineated in the statute, has presented problems. I had a case one time where there had been a notice to condemn the property. That's not, that wasn't an itemized list in this statute, as is. It's part of what we propose. And a referee said, well, it's not listed in the statute. I don't think that's an essential service, so I'm denying that request. So that put that tenant in a really odd situation, because had she filed a rent escrow action, then that action would have come to court too late for the condemnation notice. So we took a serious look at the kinds of calls that we get at Homeline. We get thousands of calls about different types of problems and came up with a list that we thought would be more definitive. And from a landlord's perspective, you know, I like laws that are definitive. I get it when it's nice as a legislator to say, well, we can't really think about what some of the variations are going to be, so let's be a little broader. But now we've had 30 years of experience with a statute. I think it's a good time to come back and say, these are some things that ought to qualify as emergencies so that landlords and tenants don't have to go to the 300 judges and referees around Minnesota from county to county and say, is this an emergency or not? So that's part of what's going on here. Another thing is to make clear that to align this process more like the lockout statute and more like the harassment statute. As the statute is right now, if a tenant files an emergency and the court believes that there's an emergency, the court doesn't have to order anything right away. It can, but it doesn't have to. It can schedule a hearing. And I'd say in the early days, courts tended to say, okay, let's landlord make this emergency repair, and then we'll have a hearing in a couple days to give you a chance to come in and say something about it. It's evolved more into a process where the courts aren't doing that. And in my experience, unless a statute says the court has to issue an order in certain parameters, it's not going to do that in an ex parte situation. So the idea here is to really align this with other types of emergencies like domestic abuse restraining orders, harassment restraining orders, lockouts, where if you convince the court that this emergency exists, that the court issues an order to correct that emergency, but then give both parties the opportunity to come in a very quick fashion and have their say about it. Now, the last thing related to heat and repairs is that this bill would reduce the filing fee to be consistent with the conciliation court filing fee. There certainly are folks very low income that can get filing fee waivers, but there are a lot of folks that aren't in that category that still have these kinds of emergencies, and to have to pay $300 to get the heat turned back on is a lot of money. The last thing is what the amendment does is adds that same filing fee reduction to lockout cases, another type of emergency case where we feel like if it's an emergency, a $300 filing fee should not prevent someone from pursuing relief for that emergency.
Mr. Smith, should we try to get your testimony in, or would you like to come back?
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm president of the Multi Housing Association. I come today to raise concerns regarding House File 3349. The proposed statewide minimum heating code does not recognize the regional differences in our large state, especially north to south. Our building code even recognizes two different zones, climate zones 6A and 7. This proposal is not well thought out relative to our climate. It doesn't recognize and pay any regard to energy efficiency standards and our growing climate crisis. This language is one size fits all that doesn't match the significant difference from Winona to Roseau. Local housing maintenance codes can be applied in the circumstance to reflect local heating requirements. With regard to the Emergency Tenant Remedies Act, the expansion to include appliances is problematic because it does not take into account the nature of property management practices, especially when we're trying to secure appliances. For example, replacing or repairing an air conditioning unit is entirely a seasonal activity. Our suppliers, understandably, have specific quantities of inventory available at the beginning of a season. If an air conditioner breaks at the end of a season and that part is no longer available, or the cost of repair is better invested in a new unit, then we are faced with the challenge of trying to find an air conditioner that doesn't exist because the seasonal inventory has been sold out. How can we comply with an ETRA in that circumstance? We can financially compensate the resident, supply fans to mitigate the situation, and in the case of disability, a disability-related necessity for air conditioning, then a reasonable accommodation would have to be made in that circumstance. These are just a few of our concerns that we have with the bill, which we oppose. Overall, the legislation simply does not account for how rental business operates. I'm always ready to be available to the chair and the author if they wish to continue to discuss our concerns. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. And Representative Herr, we do have one question, and so I think we will save the questions and vote until this evening. I'm so sorry. We have passed our time.
That's okay, Madam Chair. Thank you so much.
Okay. So, members, my understanding is we will convene at 6 p.m. or immediately following caucuses, whichever is later. Representative.
Madam Chair, just to be aware, we also have capital investment this evening, so some of us, in fact, several of us might be going back and forth.
We are in room 120 of the state capitol. Unfortunately, we couldn't get this.
And that's a longer walk.
It is a longer
just
walk.
Just in this building.
You are correct. We are in recess. We will come to order. We were in recess. And I'm told we established a quorum this morning, so we can proceed. The two questions that we had for the bill, one was Representative Pearson, who isn't here yet, and so Representative Fisher was the other person.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had was in reference to a comment I thought had been made by one of the testifiers earlier, I believe from Mr. Cecil Smith, where if I understood him right, he was mentioning that as we were taking a look at the bill, we should take a look at different parts of the states, how it should apply differently from the northern part to the southern part. And I guess
as to minimum temperature.
As to minimum temperature, and I guess the thing that I was kind of confused at is, you know, 68 degrees, you know, as a minimum temperature should be the minimum temperature whether you're in southern Minnesota or northern Minnesota. And I was kind of curious as, you know, what was being referenced there, because I don't see why there should be a difference between the northern part and the southern part of the state with a minimum temperature of 68 degrees. Unfortunately, I don't see Mr. Smith here, and I don't know if there's anyone else.
I don't know if the author had any response to that or the gentleman at the table. You can address that in closing comments too, if you would like.
We can do that, Madam Chair. Yeah,
Representative Herr.
Are we at closing comments now then, or
no? Maybe we don't.
Because I can. I think we're
well. It appears we actually don't have any more questions, so we might be at closing comments.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, thank you for allowing us to have Bill House File 3349 heard today. I want to just say a couple of small things before I renew my motion. And I did just want to say, to address a little bit about the concerns around the minimum heat. And Minneapolis has been, from what I know, has been doing it since like the late 2000s. St. Paul does this. We have not had an issue. And I know that the issue brought up about the state and having it split up into their two zones. I don't know if we want to go. I don't necessarily want to go down that route, because the truth is that with climate change, that 68 degrees, I think, is the minimum. And that if there are localities that want to actually have that be higher because they might be further north, I see more power to them, right? Like, I think that the minimum is the minimum. And I would say that I hope that our landlords can maybe all start working together to say, what do we see that's happening in climate change? And what does that mean around making sure? And our bill talks about, you know, like working refrigerators, because there are people, we are getting hotter and people are getting sicker, and that they do need refrigerators to keep their medications cool. Or they do need air conditioners, because we have hotter summers than we have before. And we do have colder winters. And so I just think that us setting a minimum is just good practice of the minimum and all of the other things that should be thought of because of climate change that is happening. I think it would just be good policy on our parts to, you know, for people to work together on what that would look like later on. So, and so I just want to leave that at that. And unless, Sam, you have something else to say?
There are.
I'm in closing testimony. Okay. Mm-hmm. So with that, I would like to just, I would like to renew my motion to I would like to renew my motion to have House File 3349 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
As amended.
As amended, yes, Madam Chair, my apologies.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That motion passes, and you are on your way, except that you're not right now, you're staying right there. And members, this is just a reminder, this particular bill was heard, we had heard discussion on this bill in the 2019 legislative session, but were unable to officially move the bill. So you're sort of bringing this back before us, even though we have already heard this particular bill. But we'll ask you to move it.
Okay, Madam Chair, and I do move my bill. My apologies. Now, I have a lot of paperwork up here. Madam Chair, I move that House File 1918 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. And I do have two authors' amendment to this bill, Madam Chair.
And you may move those. Oh, now I see Representative Pearson is here, and we just moved on to the next one. We'll have to figure out how we get that question answered.
All right, Madam Chair. And so the two authors' amendment, I have an A1 amendment and an A2 amendment. And the A1, should I move one at a time? Or
move one at a time, okay. And then just speak briefly to it.
The A1 amendment, I think, is just technical in nature here, and it is updated. See here. My apologies. Let me just look at this really quick. It's actually quite brief. We are just doing – this is just some technical, it's just some technical changes to get the bill in the order that that I'd like to have it before we present the bill.
And I can tell you, Ms. Mullen, our researcher, is unfortunately not here. She had a family obligation, I think, this evening, so we can't even have her help you out here.
No, that's okay, because
we only have our fiscal analyst, and I won't put him on the
Well, I think that if I just want to, I mean, if you just look at the, you know, like say page 2 after line 1, we're just inserting item number 8, and that is state facility as defined in section 24.650.
Nine.
And then page 2, line 2, we're just deleting 8 and inserting 9, and then the following line 9 to 10. So it really is just technical changes, Madam Chair.
And author's amendment A1 has been moved. I see no further questions. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That amendment is adopted, and now you have the A2.
And the A2 amendment is just changing the effective date, Madam Chair. So if you look at page 3, it's deleting lines 11 and 12, and it's just changing the effective date. No, actually, it's not. Yeah, it's just changing the effective date from 2020 to 2021.
That has been moved. I see no questions. The author's amendment is before us, A2. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. That amendment is adopted. And I see no further questions on this. As I said, we heard discussion on the bill in the 2019 legislative session, but were unable to officially move the bill, so now we are sending it on to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division.
That's right. Correct, Madam Chair.
And I see no further comments, so if you have any closing remarks on this.
It's a really good bill, and I do just ask for all of your support. Thank you.
Representative Herr renews her motion that House File 1918 be, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. That motion carries.
I might need that one someday.
And members, I'm going to stay right here because our vice chair might be called out momentarily because we all have bills up, and so I'll just stay right here in the chair because this is a department bill, and so Mr. Kitzberger from the Minnesota Housing will join us, and I have just one brief opening statement, and then he'll give you the further description. Members, you may recall that we had a year-long task force on housing, and there was a report on that. And then, so that it wouldn't just be a report that went up on the shelf, there was another group formed called Prosperity's Front Door. And they have sort of kept a look at this, and they, I think just last week, had a press conference in which they issued a report card, I think they called it, Minnesota Housing Scorecard, And I'll just briefly talk about that and then single out the one item that I think is why you're bringing this issue before us. Goal one was to commit to homes as a priority, and they gave us a strong start. Goal three was to build more homes, and they said we're making slow progress. Goal four was increasing home stability, and they said we were making a strong start. Goal five was link homes and services, and they said we are making slow progress. Goal six, however, was support and strengthen home ownership, where they said we're losing ground. Goal two was preserve the homes we have, and that, they said, we are losing ground. And so the department brings this issue before us because the accelerating loss of naturally occurring affordable housing coupled with scarce resources and the slow pace of adding new affordable rental units has raised concerns from stakeholders about the need to prioritize longer terms of affordability for multifamily developments receiving resources through Minnesota Housing. And I think that paragraph and that goal, I think, are motivation for why you bring this issue before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm with Minnesota Housing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here I am in the chair and to make my motion. I move House File 3451 be referred to the General Register, and now you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, Dan Kitzberger with Minnesota Housing. I appreciate the chair carrying this bill on behalf of the agency. As she sort of indicated, we're looking to maximize our length of time a multifamily property remains affordable. So we're proposing amending the section of statute that makes lands and covenants restrictions invalid after 30 years. So we hear through our public comment periods and our community engagement efforts concerns about developers that will often leverage certain scarce resources only to convert and sell off their properties as soon as the required affordability terms expire. There's still a demand to be met for this kind of housing. I want to be very clear about that in the near term. But given the number of affordable units that we lose every year compared to what we preserve or build, we need to be thinking about prioritizing longer terms of affordability. So in response to this request of our community development partners and to better address the statewide shortage of housing that's affordable, we've actually as an agency expanded use of 40-year affordability terms in our multifamily loan documents and in our tax credit documents. So an applicant for either of these resources can now get extra points by agreeing to longer terms of affordability. So this is an incentive that we're able to provide within our scoring that allows us to prioritize these terms of affordability while still allowing developers to submit applications that prioritize and can earn points in other ways. So there's a provision in state statute currently that makes this certain kind of covenant restriction invalid after 30 years. And basically in year 29, we can jump through various hoops to remove that restriction, but we think it would just be more straightforward for our developer partners and for us on the front end to be able to, if they're willing, make an agreement for longer term affordability beyond 30 years. So that's the change in the bill before you today, and I can hopefully answer any questions you might have.
Question for Mr. Kitzberger. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is, so are the terms, the new terms that would be applied, locally defined then? Or who makes that decision? And the existing ones that are out there that expire at year 30, the choice of the current owner has that now and could extend it at any time, or do they have to wait till year 30?
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, as far as whose decision it is, it's the decision largely of the agency or the government entity providing the funding along with the developer. So it's still entirely possible that a developer after the term of affordability may decide that they no longer want to keep those units affordable. That's well within their rights of the agreement that they make with the agency. One of the things that we see is that, so in terms of our tax credit financing, is oftentimes the sub-allocators are four sub-allocators in addition to Minnesota Housing of tax credits. They often kind of follow our lead in terms of what happens in the QAP. So if one of those sub-allocators is involved in a tax credit financing development, they are then, we may see them kind of follow our lead and move in this direction. Again, not making it a requirement, but one of the options to make an application more competitive.
Okay, and one more question then. So if they decide they have 10 years left or something and they decide they want to extend it, is the length of the extension negotiable as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, yes, it would be. This is an agreement. I mean, it could be a two-way street, theoretically. We hear this from a number of our developers. And again, there are a number of developers whose model is able to make use of certain types of financing and then convert the property to market rate after that use. We think that's fine. However, there are certain developers out there who would like to be able to maximize points in our application based on longer terms of affordability. So we want that option to be available too.
All right. And Madam Chair, thank you for bringing it forward. I think that this is clearly a need, and where we can extend that affordable housing, we should work on doing that, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yeah, thanks for carrying the department's bill. I guess I'm not as convinced about the need, and so I'm just going to follow up with a couple questions to determine that. In the last in your portfolio of the projects that are graduating out of their contracts right now, you know, are we seeing most of those go back to a market-based rentals then at this point, or if you could give us some explanation of that need, that defined need of, you know, all of these are going back into the privates in the market-based versus affordable housing sector, that'd be helpful for us to know.
Mr. Kitzberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, that's a good question. I don't know exactly what percentage of our, it'd be mostly our tax credit portfolio at this point that's impacted by this. I think what we're thinking about is in terms of the broader marketplace. We do know that in terms of naturally occurring affordable housing, we lose on net about 2,000 units a year. Now, those are actually units that are affordable without government subsidy. And so we just want to make sure that with the scarce resources we have available through public entities, that we are doing as much as we can to replace those units that are lost through regular market transactions every year. So if it's helpful for you, I can try to follow up with that number that we lose out of our portfolio. Okay.
If you would.
Madam Chair, that would be appreciated. I would like that. But just, you know, just anecdotally, you know, looking at a 30-year complex of any size or scale, it's going to be one of the more affordable existing units that's out there. I definitely understand the motivation, even from the developer's standpoint, of wanting to score and qualify for the available financing that's out there. So I certainly understand, you know, what you're trying to do to leverage that and kind of guarantee that. But I am just curious, how is that actually, how is that impacted? And when it goes back to the market rate, how is that market rate competitive with what we now are building, which are these new affordable rental units? They might actually be less expensive in the open market compared to what we will be building 30 years from today as new affordable rental units, which was the term that was thrown out. And again, for me, I'm constantly pushing back on that, just saying that's not the only way we can do this. And I appreciate the department's search for solutions in those other categories.
So it sounds like you will get back to him.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, I can follow up on that.
I don't see any other questions. After we call for the vote on this, it's my intention, since Representative Pearson, Representative Herr, if you're okay with this, you've been very gracious about listening to questions, and because you have another committee stop, if you remember what your question was this morning,
exactly.
You could, so as soon as we call for the, if you are wanting to get it on the record, and then that might be something you can carry to the next committee. Mm-hmm. So that That's my intention after this vote. I see no further questions on this, so I will renew my motion that House File 3451 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That motion prevails.
Thank you.
So if you happen to recall, otherwise you could visit with her.
The bill that we were on?
And the reason I know, she's taken some notes on some suggestions you made, and I understand is going to follow up with you. So I know it's the author's intention.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Madam Chair, I do kind of remember. Because we, and this is just a general conversation more than anything else, and it's this constant tension of giving notice and what's considered an emergency, and now we're putting a requirement that the thermostat be able to be at 68 degrees. And that's a circular discussion that, again, the dynamics, it maybe is a little bit more of a comment. The question would be in the form of something like, you know, does our new 24-hour notice rule, along with being in and out of the apartment within the certain time parameters, you know, we're putting one restriction on, and then we're putting a new requirement on, and it sounds like what we do to our public schools all the time. You know, it's just this tension of asking the landlord to do more, giving them less time and opportunity to do that, and 24-hour notice of doing that. And I would again argue what we did in statute this morning was really put the landlord in a huge statutory liability, because there's no protection for the landlord. We do have a lot of things in another bill that defined virtually everything as an emergency too. So other than marketing the property to the next tenant, I feel like we're saying everything's an emergency, and then nothing becomes an emergency too. So I was curious if you knew if the 24-hour rules would be impacted on that 68 requirement for the thermostat on heating. And it's not a specific question, so if you don't want to deal with it,
and
it's fine.
And Representative Herr, we actually still have an attorney in the room who might have an opinion on this if you wanted to call a friend.
Yeah, absolutely, if our attorney has a response. And I do just want to say that I appreciate the question. I'm still not sure about the connection between the 24-hour rule and the key to being the heat at 68 for a certain number of months, but I'd be more than willing to have a conversation with you. You can maybe share a little bit more information with me offline, and then I can see what I can do with it. Thank you. Since she has
another stop.
Sure.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Sure. So, I'm sorry, I am supposed to talk?
Please.
I don't know if you heard that.
I heard the exchange. I'm going to need to narrow down the questions if possible. My name is Michael Vra. I'm the managing attorney at Homeline. So, I'm sorry. Could you try to separate that into one or two direct questions?
Well, the question was during the bill that was being testified about, and I don't want to get into a long debate over everything else, but what we had prior to this bill being heard, we were having the discussion of new statutorial requirements that would say a landlord could not enter a premises without giving 24-hour notice, and also couldn't enter the premises between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8, or after, before 8 a.m. and after 8 p.m. And these were privacy concerns that were brought up. But for me, it's this contrast or this conflict that's always in place of how does a landlord provide, and how do we in statute, was what I meant by the collective we, how do we in statute protect the tenant from making sure that the property is at 68 degrees while also protecting their privacy and making all of that work within a 24-hour notice time frame.
So I'm just trying to picture, and I apologize for not being formal. We're not actually.
No, we're just, I just thought as a courtesy, because we recessed right in the middle of that debate, that I would just extend this privilege.
Sure. So in your scenario, the tenant has asked the landlord to come over and fix the heat because it's below 68 degrees. Is that what you're envisioning?
Well, the.
How else would the landlord know?
The statute, that's a good question for the author of the bill also. The statute is reading that the thermostat has to be maintained 68 degrees.
Sure. But the landlord won't know that unless the tenant complains about the lack of heat. So the tenant is instigating the whole issue almost certainly. And once they do that, then the landlord can certainly set up a time with the tenant. One thing that's, I think, missed earlier this morning was that the landlord can knock on the door any time and say, can I come in? And if the tenant opens the door and lets them in, that's fine. Just like you or I can knock on a tenant's door and say, can I come in? The question we're really dealing with is, when can the landlord use their key?
Madam Chair, and again, that actually gets to the question I had this morning. I don't think in statute you're correct. And again, what's being done is we're saying that we're maintaining a lease. We're right. Drawing into and maintaining a lease. Those are two things that were added to the bill as well. And so by knocking on the door and saying, can I come in, that's an agreement, and that's in the course of maintaining a lease. Isn't that correct? Right. So we're restricting that in the new language in this bill.
Actually, the language you're talking about is already there. We're not changing when can the landlord go in when the landlord needs permission to enter. They can still, today, the law is they can knock on the door and ask to come in. That's not different from what's in the statute that's proposed.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Sounds like ongoing conversation.
You bet.
Well, I just thought, given that we broke the debate right in the middle of it, I just thought we'd kind of close the loop, and because you are gracious and always willing to take additional comment. So I think our business has concluded. We are adjourned.